stumbled upon Pitaga's trap, Kurunt accounted. Thousands would now lie dead had the army entire wandered on into the Carrion Gorge unawares. The king himself. You, Tukanti. All of us.
As Mua stifled an angry reply, Volker looked to the skies, then across to the tree line. At last the Sherdan shook his head, pointing to the branches of the nearest elm. A long-eared owl sat there, watching them pensively.
A nightbird watches us. It is an omen we should heed. It is night, and thus we should make camp. All of us.
It is a day hunter, Hattu said. Mua swung to him again. The troops nearby were watching on now. His eyes are amber, Hattu continued, hearing Ruba's voice from the classroom. Like the sun. This means he hunts by day. Only black-eyed owls are night predators. There is no omen here. Volker sneered dismissively. Mua's face twisted.
Return to your ranks, soldier,
he spat.
Perhaps there is merit in sending a troop of archers ahead, Tukanti.
Nuanza now argued.
They could move silently and with mud and dark garb so as not to be seen.
Coulter stroked his forked beard and added,
We still don't know exactly how many warriors Pitaga has with him. Any knowledge would be a boost to our hopes.
Mua swung to the pair. Hattu could see the signs. The few times in years past when his brother's temper had exploded, all reason and wisdom cast aside. By now, most of the soldiers had heard the terse words of their leaders and had turned to watch.
Camp here and send a troop forward, as Prince Hattu suggests,
one group of Roth soldiers muttered.
The son of Ishtar has been a good omen so far, has he not?
Tukanti has chosen,
Volker cut in, stepping over to stand beside Mua.
Prepare camp. We remain here for the night, Volker concluded. There will be no advance party.
Mua seemed to draw in a sharp breath, his dark and taut eyes fixed on Hattu. Hattu imagined 100 whispered, acid words travelling upon his brother's fiery gaze. As the three divisions set about fortifying the clearing with a strong watch around the edge and a rough, circular palisade of spears, Volker sat on the driver's berth of the king's wagon, watching the men at work on the defences, then settling down to cook their evening meals. Darkness seemed to descend swiftly, and the rhododendron forest penning them in was now pure black, illuminated only by the occasional set of staring gemstone eyes of curious watching animals. Then there was another set of eyes. Different. Narrowed. Narrowed on him. Slowly, ever so slowly, he gave the slightest of nods. Hattu felt his eyelids grow heavy as he sat by the fire, watching the horses and mules cropping at grass, listening to Dagon's gentle, wistful song.
The wind howls like a hound, yet none flinch at the sound. As rain lashes the fields, in calm prayer we kneel. When snow blankets the walls, our proud sentries stand tall. Thunder rolls through the sky, yet the children don't cry. For they were born in mighty Hattusa.
The song conjured an image in Hattu's mind, of him and Atir standing on the Acropolis walls, hugging each other for warmth, watching arrow bank and dart through the sky. He pulled the tight leather string holding his hair in a tail, the locks falling around his face. He found the lock with the beryl stone on it, held it to his lips and kissed it.
Tomorrow I will find you.
He saw Mua across the camp, sitting cross-legged, head bowed, chin resting on steepled fingers.
Tomorrow, brother, I pray for her sake and yours. She has not come to any harm because of our delay here.
Another spoonful of his half-eaten bowl of rabbit broth, another mouthful of watered wine, and Hattu felt drowsiness creep across his mind. He gazed out into the blackness of the forest. Darkness. Sleep. And, right at the perimeter by the wolf's fire, eyes.
Human eyes?
What the... he gasped, suddenly alert and shooting to his feet, sparks rising from the fire with him. The wolves rose too, startled. Tanku's sword screeched as he drew it. Dagon hoisted a spear. A figure emerged from the trees, hobbling.
Slowly,
the nearest sentry demanded, keeping his spear tip trained on the newcomer. It was an old woman, her back hunched and her hair hanging in tousled clumps, like the lichen of the forest.
"My, never have I seen so many faces in one place," she croaked,
in the Hatton Zooan tongue, eyeing the 15,000 men in the clearing.
"Hittites,"
she mused, noticing their garb and features.
"Who are you?"
Muwa barked, striding over from the royal tent area to see what was happening, adding his sword point to Tanku's.
"A villager,"
she snapped, now in the Hittite tongue, flicking her head back towards the north from whence she had come, her nose shriveling.
"And you ought to show a little more respect, boy."
Muwa seemed disarmed by her motherly rebuke. "She is alone," Hattu confirmed, eyes searching the darkness within the trees. Muwa's top lip twitched.
"I can see that," he growled, tucking his sword back into his belt. "Why are you here?"
"I walk these woods, and I stop here every evening to fetch water."
The old woman pointed to the brook, then the rickety old handcart she was towing, an empty bucket sitting on it. Nwanza, Coulter, and Kurunta had gathered now too, along with a crowd of soldiers. Muwa eyed the woods once more, then narrowed his eyes.
"And have you come across the Kaskan tribes tonight?"
She frowned.
"By the gods, no. And may every day forth be the same."
He waved a hand as if to clear a path for her to the brook. She hobbled forwards with a sigh, then stopped to sniff the air like a hound, curling her bottom lip in disappointment.
"If you tire of that grim broth you all seem to be cooking,"
she said loud enough for many nearby units to hear,
"then you will find plenty of nourishment in these honeycombs."
She gestured to the handcart. Piled in there were pale yellow waxy shards, broken chunks of hives. Kurunta blew air through his lips, impressed by the hag's impertinence.
"Don't mind if I do,"
he said, reaching over and taking one of the shards, dipping his finger into the waxy lattice and sucking the thick, runny liquid from the tip.
"Lovely. And interesting," he said.
Soldiers from each division harvested chunks of the nectar too. A voice nagged insistently in Hattu's mind, stirred by the sight of the honeycomb. What was it Ruba had told him? But Volker appeared at that moment.
"We'll lighten your burden,"
he grinned, tossing the old woman a small bag of copper rings.
"And let's spare most for the watchmen, eh? It'll keep them alert. Pass it round,"
he said, taking one entire disc of comb and passing it on to the nearest perimeter sentry, who gladly broke off a piece and passed it round to the next guardsman. Hattu noticed the old woman's face had drooped. She looked up at him, one half of her mouth raised in a sad smile.
"I'd best be on my way," she muttered.
Hattu saw that the leather bucket in her cart was empty. "But your water?"
"Ah,"
she sighed.
Yes.
She hobbled over to the brook and awkwardly crouched to try to fill the bucket. Hattu pitied the sight. He walked over, taking the bucket and bending to fill it for her.
"You are a kind young man,"
she said. More words seemed to be stuck behind her lips, but she said nothing.
"Thank you for the honey," Hattu said. "It will invigorate us for tomorrow, when I will free my love from Kaskan hands."
"Hmm,"
she replied.
"You have seen them, haven't you?" he asked.
"You build fine houses in Hittite lands, I hear,"
she mused. Hattu frowned.
"There are fine palaces, shacks and shanty houses too, though."
"Your love,"
she said.
"If she was in a burning room and her family were in another, if the house was about to collapse and you could save only one, which would it be?"
"That is a cruel choice," Hattu replied.
"Aye, it is,"
she muttered. And off she went. Hattu watched her melt back into the woods. Dagon shoved a triangle of waxy comb into his hand and patted his back.
"It is wondrous,"
he mumbled through a mouthful of the stuff. They sat around the fire once more, and he sucked out a good helping of honey, smacking his lips in satisfaction and drawing some soldier bread from his bag to dip into the comb. It was sweet and energizing. Kurunta sat near him, and for the first time Hattu realized he was glad of the one-eyed leader's nearness. He gazed at Kurunta's eye patch as he ate. The vengeful general was a myth, Karunta was a steadfast warrior, a pillar upon which the king stood. Why, he wondered, had father taken his eye?
You'll never work it out,
Karunta said quietly, without looking up from his shard of honeycomb.
Sir?
Attu said, startled.
Many a story has been conjured about this,
he said, tapping a finger on his eye patch.
Aye. They whisper about me just as much as they whisper about you, lad.
Tell me, Attu said gently. Karunta sighed deeply and examined the ground before him, gazing through the earth as if it was a window to a past era.
Some say I lost it in a brawl with the king's guards. One Hercler spread the tale that I was caught in the king's chambers at night with a knife. Others claim the king himself pinned me down and scooped it out with a spoon, wrenching with his bare hands at the sinew and tendons that dangled from the socket until they snapped away too.
Attu stopped chewing on his sweetened bread, mildly disgusted, but also wondering who else was listening. Nobody. The rest of the wolves were busy chatting amongst themselves.
I don't believe any of those tales, Attu said.
Karunta flicked his head to one side, as if uncomfortable with the intimate words.
And I believe you are no cursed son.
Attu frowned, chewing his bread slowly now. He was sure the general would say no more.
It happened many years ago,
Karunta added after a silence.
271 men patrol the dark earth because of me.
Attu felt a shiver across his back.
It wasn't long after the Mitannian Wars had ended. I was a regimental chief then, posted to the dry flats of Nuhashi. The king had given the order for all patrols and garrisons to withdraw from the area, as we expected a strong uprising from the loyalist locals. But a sandstorm kicked up, you see. The king's word was withdraw, but I knew my men would suffer were we to march on in that stinging tempest. So I led them into a small abandoned mud fort. The fort was bleak, but sheltered enough for us to at least draw breath and wait the storm out.
Attu shrugged. The logic was sound.
Then come morning, the storm had faded. But the local tribes had gathered around the fort in their thousands. They'd barred the gates from the outside. Expert bowmen in those lands.
He smiled without a crumb of humour.
They shot us down like pigs in a pen. Every last one of us. Except me.
Attu felt a stone settle in his belly at the bleak tale.
So an arrow took your eye.
Karunta shook his head.
Somehow I was unhurt. The locals left. I clambered from the fort over the rampart of heaped corpses. I staggered back through the baked wastes until I reached Aleppo's walls, where the king and his various forces had retreated to. I disobeyed my superior's orders, the king's orders. The punishment is clear enough. Blinding, as has always been the way.
My father did not hear your story,
Attu asked, looking once to the royal wagon, then back to Karunta.
Aye, he listened, Karunta nodded. And he spared me.
Then he turned to Attu, his face bent in disgust.
But is the cruelest punisher not the one within?
He tapped his temple.
I could not live with the memory of their deaths, the reality that they had died while I did not. I needed to feel something. Something other than guilt.
A horrible sense of understanding settled on Hattu's shoulders.
You asked for the eye to be taken.
I begged the king, Karunta said quietly. I begged him as others might beg to keep their lives. And when it was done, I found that it helped. A little.
They ate more in silence, sharing a skin of watered wine. Eventually, Attu asked Karunta of the better times in the Mitannian Wars, and of simple things like his life outside the army, with his wife and his beloved pigs in Hattusa. The general struggled to speak of these things, but Attu could see he was eager to try. After a while, he noticed the watered wine flooding to his head even more swiftly than before. His blood felt warm, and he noticed that despite the air growing cool with the darkness of night, a layer of balmy sweat had spread across his skin. He held up his water skin and the small wine flask, both blurry and outlined by the moon and its silver halo.
"Gods, this wine is strong,"
Karunta remarked, shaking his head like a wet dog. Dagon nearby turned to Hattu and Karunta.
"Are you feeling it too? It's as if I've drunk the lot," he said, blinking hard.
Giddiness seemed to take hold within moments, and he heard many of the other soldiers laughing, some uproariously. Tanku rocked on his haunches, hooting with laughter at some weak joke Sargis had aired. Then he fell onto his back as if hit by a stiff wind, looked dazed for a moment, then exploded with more laughter. Then suddenly he seemed to fall prey to a sudden fright, clutching out at the ground around him, kicking, his face agog.
"Spiders!"
he yelped, booting at a bare patch of earth, then sweeping nothing from his shoulders and swinging round, eyeing every patch of ground with terror.
"Oh, they're everywhere!"
Hattu realized the enjoyable warmth of the wine and honey had changed within him, too. He felt his head begin to swim, and saw the faces all around him blur and contort like melting wax. Even the trees seemed to writhe and sway in the still night air like spirits. The vapor from the forest seemed to crawl out from the shadows and pour around him, enshrouding him. And now of all the cursed moments, he recalled Ruba's words.
"A trader friend of mine used to go months on the road with few supplies. He would gather water from streams, shoot hare and geese, raid beehives for their nectar. One year, he didn't stop by Hattusa as usual. It turns out he'd eaten honey from a bad hive. Somewhere in the north. A bitch of a forest, he said."
Nausea swirled deep in Hattu's stomach, rising and boiling in his chest. Nearby, he heard the sounds of retching and spitting. The laughter had faded. He heard thick thuds of men crumpling to the ground, and saw the sentries around the spear palisade sinking to their knees.
"It's poisonous," he groaned weakly.
The memory of the dead bees on the forest floor stung him.
"Of course.
Stop!"
he cried with all the air in his lungs, seeing his comrades still greedily eating.
"The honey is bad,"
he yelled, batting the shards of comb from the hands of the nearest. Around him, other men rose, tossing down the shards of comb before they had eaten too much, gawping at the state of their comrades. He retched, spilling the contents of his belly onto the earth. When he lifted his head again, he saw the writhing woods. This was no illusion. They were moving. He spun round, moving in every direction, coming through the trees like a silent noose drawing tight. Men. A ring of armed men.
"Kaskans? It's a trap! A ploy!"
he rasped.
"Kaskans!"
Dagon yelled, seeing it now too. The cries spilled from the lips of a few others, then exploded in one almighty chorus. A thunder of boots sounded all around him. Those who were able raced to cover the perimeter where the sentries had fallen. They coughed and spat, taking up their shields, swords and spears.
"More men! More!"
Karunta howled, swaying alone at an unguarded stretch of the perimeter. Hattu, Dagon and Sargis and a knot of 15 other wolves were fit to go to his aid. They clattered into place with him, forming a wall of shields behind the spear palisade. Hattu gazed into the blackness, seeing the fiery, eager eyes of the mountain men coming to within a handful of paces of the clearing's edge. But the boom, boom, boom of Hittite shields and the clack, clack of spears being levelled multiplied. Hattu shot a look over his shoulder. The perimeter was covered. Thinly, but covered all the same.
"Tarunda, Kotmai,"
Karunta gasped, struggling.
"Kotmai heart in bronze,"
Dagon and Hattu finished for him. Another chorus followed, rich, full, defiant. The cry fell away. The Kaskan noose slowed to a halt, deathly silent. It was a moment in which men considered their very lives, a battle of wills. Then, with a muted rumble of boots and gruff voices, the Kaskan watchers receded, the cruel eyes and sharp weapons melting back into the blackness. Hattu stared at the spot they had been for what felt like an eternity.
"They're gone! The woods are clear!"
cried Goru the Mercedes from the far side of the perimeter.
"Clear this side too,"
Orax replied a moment later.
"Damned hag! A moment later and we would have been like..."
Karunta started.
pigs in a pen.
Hattu rested his spear on its haft, panting. His head ached, feeling as though he was wearing a red-hot and way-too-tight bronze helm. Muwa staggered over, head switching this way and that, eyes alive with fear that the danger was still keen.
Up! Up!
He demanded of the prone, retching men. Nearly half of the army lay like this.
We have the perimeter covered, Tukansi,
Kurunta reassured him. Volker leapt down from the driver's berth of the royal wagon and strode over. Hattu noticed how he wore an odd look on his face, like that of a man denied the company of a woman. But as he approached, his face changed, handsome, bright, and smiling.
Give worship to the gods,
he bawled, so all could hear. Then he took one of Hattu's hands and raised it in the air.
And give thanks to Prince Hattu, the brightest mind amongst us tonight, for raising the alarm before we fell prey to the Kaskans. Ishtar truly has blessed him with her gifts.
Many heads had turned to the address now. Most rose clenched fists in support.
Son of Ishtar!
They cried in a baritone chorus. Muwa's maddened eyes darted all around at the men lording Hattu. King Masili held the wagon curtain open, seeing the strange glade they were in. He felt a horrible sense of puzzlement at his whereabouts. The air smelt odd. The trees looked wrong. Then he saw an old hag give out honey to the men. He heard their cheery talk, especially the perimeter sentries, as they ate. Oddly, he felt no appetite for the fare. Tired by the small effort of observation, he made to lie back down again, when the wagon rocked a little. Volker had leapt up to sit on the driver's bench with a shard of the waxy nectar. But while the other men ate, Volker merely watched. Odder still, the Sherdan then dropped his piece of honeycomb and didn't bother picking it up again. Masili fell back into a deep sleep. When he woke, it was to terrible sounds, sounds of wounded men. He tried to prop himself up on his right elbow, but even those muscles were failing him. He managed only to lift his trembling right hand to the curtain and draw it back a fraction.
Oh, by Tahunda's grace, what is this?
Men staggered and fell, vomited, pitched over as if shot. Befuddled, he poked his head from the wagon windows and looked around for Lady Danuhipa. She could help them, just as she had helped him. But she was absent, far away, back in Hattusa, he realized, feeling foolish. Instead, he saw Volker. The red-cloaked Sherdan sat there on the driver's berth of the wagon, watching, while his comrades fell.
Help them,
Masili said in a half-whisper. But the Galmasedi continued to watch motionless as they fell. He was like a sober man in an Arzana house.
Stop! The honey is bad!
A cry sounded.
Hattu,
Masili mouthed. He heard muffled exchanges, then a brash cry.
Son of Ishtar!
The moniker crept across his skin like wriggling insects.
Hattu,
he whispered. Then another shout.
Lord your king and your chosen prince, not mere foot soldiers.
Muwa,
he croaked, hearing his older son's words clash with the cries of acclaim like a sword. He tried to twist his head, to look round and locate his sons. Then Volker filled the squared window and cupped a hand behind Masili's head to lift it a little, then held a skin to his lips.
All is in hand, my son. Now drink. Drink it all. It will help things along,
he said in a soothing voice. The root brew flooded into Masili's mouth, washing away the confused thoughts. He drank every last drop, then fell back into a deep, exhausted slumber. Chapter 17. Island of the Dead, Summer 1300 BC. With a cacophony of snapping twigs and branches, the Hittite army surged through the northern half of the rhododendron forest the following day. Men bore fiery looks and marched doggedly, despite many sporting sore heads and foul bellies. Hattu looked ahead, to the king's carriage, making its way through the woods with great difficulty, and behind to Muwa, leading the fury with a face that did justice to the name. A hand clasped onto Hattu's shoulder. It was the slit-eyed, aged captain from the Leopard Clan, His face was stony still, but his words were very different now.
My granddaughter was born the day we left Hattusa. I was fearful I might never return to see her, to hold her. Last night in the woods, I thought we were done for. But you saved us, Prince Hattusili. I will never again speak ill of you.
Hattu tilted his head a little to one side, unsure how to respond, then saluted. At last they broke clear of the muggy dark woods and found before them a broad, verdant heath, bathed in noonday sunshine. Just ahead lay another carcass of a Kaskan camp, a sea of mud domes and rough timber shacks, pig bones, broken clay pots, uncovered cesspits. And as they approached, they saw something else. Three spears, hafts fixed in the earth, long-haired human heads impaled upon the tips. Around the two spears at the sides lay torn white Hittite soldier garb. By the base of the central one was a black garment, a priestess robe. Even from here, Hattu could see the ragged section where a strip had been torn off. His hand moved to the rag in his purse, his eyes fixed on the impaled head.
Oh, no,
he whispered, feeling his body tremble.
Stay back,
Kurunta cried across the lines. He and Nuanza at once scouring the seemingly empty landscape for further threat. But Hattu broke ranks and staggered forward, sliding to his knees before the three heads. He barely noticed Muwa do likewise by his side. Laments rang out from the men behind. Tendrils of bloody sinew and skin trailed from the leftmost head, the flesh blackened and the poor guard's face unrecognizable. The cheeks and forehead of the rightmost guard's head pulsed and writhed for a moment in a grim parody of life, before a set of black shiny pincers cut through the skin from within and a flood of insects and maggots spilled over his face. The last head, that of the priestess, was veiled by hair, just the gaping mouth visible. Muwa and Hattu looked at one another pale, then reached up together to sweep the hair back. The elder priestess's lifeless face was twisted in the pain of her final moments.
Bury them,
Muwa snapped, rising and turning away.
We should have sent a force ahead. You should have listened to me,
Hattu called after him.
They were here. Last night, Atia was here. We could have freed her.
Muwa swung to cast a scourge-like glower on him. He shot a fiery look of his own back. A murmur broke out amongst the men as they watched their two princes quarrel like this. Arrow flew down from above the woods to join them just then, settling before Hattu's feet as if to mediate.
Had you done the job I asked of you, prepared the Topeka escort properly, then she would never have been taken captive.
Muwa raked his fingers through his hair then, with a snarl, kicked out at Arrow, who hopped back and screeched at him.
Damn bird! I'll cook it, if it gets in my way again.
The many watching ranks gasped in shock and dismay, as Hattu fell to one knee to scoop Arrow up.
They say death follows you, brother. Well, look!
Muwa towered over him, gesturing at the heads.
Look!
Hattu's limbs shook with fury. Muwa swung away and stalked back to the army lines. Had he not, Hattu wondered just what anger might have driven him to do. The Hittite army marched on through the sultry north, following the Kaskan tracks like hounds. They trekked through marshy flats, over low bluffs and winding hill tracks. Only dusk halted them, and they set up camp on a green saddle of land between two brown earthy hills, each peak serving as a natural lookout post. Hattu woke in the middle of the night, his thoughts nagging him. The argument with Muwa echoing over and over in his head. And any time he did start to doze off, the grim image of the spiked heads stained the brief beginnings of innocent dreams. When he heard the urgent chatter of sentries atop one of the lookout hills, he woke fully. Many of the wolves were already awake, chatting mutedly or polishing their armor. He nodded to a few as he rose and dressed, then made his way to the brown earth slope and climbed to the hilltop. The night air was cool up here, and he could see for many danna in every direction. The lookout sentries were in deep discussion with Raku Flatface, pointing and gesticulating towards a kidney-shaped lake a few danna away, its surface reflecting the crescent of the waning moon like a highly polished sickle blade. Trouble? Hattu said. Raku turned to him.
On that islet,
he said. Hattu followed his outstretched finger. He noticed how a section of the lake's surface moved and roiled, ever so slowly. It was not quite black, he realized, as his eyes adjusted, but grey. Mist crawled across the water, and he could just make out a crooked neck of land stretching out into the lake, a causeway leading to a small isle.
One of the horse scouts reckons it's an old sacrificial isle, sacred to the Kaskans,
Raku said.
We saw torchlight on it,
one of the lookout sentries said.
And up here we heard a distant noise carrying on the night breeze,
the other sentry added.
A terrible noise.
Hattu's smoke-grey eye ached as he scoured the misty islet. For just the briefest of moments he thought he saw a dull orb of orange, the flicker of a fire, or a torch, right enough. What if she is there? He fretted. He felt a pang in his breast, an urgent need to find out, to right the wrong, to shove Muwa's cruel and unjust accusations down his throat. He felt his emotions run high, and took a moment to think, rubbing his temples, trying to let his mind make sense of it, and not his heart, just as Nuanza had taught him, and the wolves at the academy.
A good soldier knows when to become deaf to his heart.
He eyed the scene again. Bare countryside lay around the lake's near shore. The approach was free of ambush points, as best as he could tell from the pale moonlight. The darkness would aid any covert investigation. More, the causeway offered an excellent means by which to pin down whoever was on that islet. The cold, clear pieces of his thinking clicked together, his head and heart in accord. We should send a scouting party, he said flatly.
Aye,
Raku agreed. Does the Tukanti know? Hattu said, the words sticking in his throat. Raku shook his head.
The Tukanti sleeps. He placed me in charge of night scouting.
Now Hattu's heart took over. Then send the wolves, he said, gesturing to the restless company down on the saddle between the hills. Raku looked doubtful.
I don't know, Prince Hattu.
Hattu clasped a hand to Raku's bicep and held his gaze, in the way he had seen father regard men. We hesitated in the woods. Let us not make the same mistake here. Coll of the Eagle Kin had always been a selfless type. The kind of fellow who enjoyed a tasty meal most of all if he gave it to another more in need. And he had spent much of his life giving what little he had. His wheat, wine, bread, and meat rations often went straight to the House of the Wounded, a wing in Hattusa's great barracks where the stricken veterans lived out their days, blind men, one-legged men, and poor wretches confined to their beds. He would cook hearty stews for them and listen to their stories. In his boyhood, tasty meals were few and far between. Indeed, food of any sort was a luxury. Living in Hattusa's slums, he'd often given what meagre fare he could buy to his sickly young sister. They owned a ramshackle hut, left to them by their plague-claimed parents, and they would huddle there at night, eating scraps of bread or the thinnest of soups, hearing the night calls of the wretched in the slum streets, staggering between taverns. He would cradle her in his arms and tell her tall tales of adventure and good deeds to drown out the sorry din. One summer a nobleman, low on slaves, had hired him. The rich man had put him to work on a sprawling villa up on Tahunda's shoulder. He spent many days there, mending the roof under a cruel sun, wearing his fingers to the nub in the process. By dusk on the last day, the roof was mended, and Coll could barely stand. He almost fell down the last few rungs of the ladder. The nobleman had thrown two thin copper rings across the dust towards him, in the way a man might toss a scrap of meat to ward off a mangy dog. Coll did not dwell on the chasm between the rich man's lot and his. What good would it do to moan over that which he did not have? Instead, he loped down the hill into the Ambar Valley Market to trade one ring for four eggs and a sweet loaf, then to the Storm Temple to place the other ring before the votive altar by the gates, whispering a few words of prayer for his sister's well-being. Someone claimed they later saw the noble taking the offered ring back for himself, but Coll chose not to believe the story. A man was little more than his thoughts, he had always said, and if you chose to dwell on the darker thoughts, then they would become you, and you them. Instead, he cooked the eggs, broke and buttered the sweet loaf, fed his sister and told her a new story, where she was the heroine at the heart of the adventure. He noticed that her smile was broader than ever, and that her breaths seemed shallower. When she fell asleep in his arms that night, it was forever. It had been the saddest moment of his life, but he did not cry, for he knew beyond doubt that he had done everything in his power to make her short life as pleasant as possible.
"Sleep well,"
he had whispered, kissing her cold forehead. For those precious few moments of introspection, Cole could see nothing, hear nothing. He was a boy again, his sister alive once more. He could feel nothing of the grazes and bruises on his skin from the ambush on the approach to Topeka, recall none of the horrors his Kaskan captors had subjected him and his comrades to since. It was akin to being underwater. Then, like a diver being hauled from the depths, the sound of all going on around him returned, sharp, brutal sounds of metal ripping skin, of harrowing cries, and of foreign tongues barking out dark oaths to strange gods.
"A good fisherman knows how to fillet a carp,"
a Kaskan laughed, as the soaring continued. Cole's eyes slid open to see a veil of coiling mist. He could smell the coppery stink of blood and the stench of loosened bowels, mixed in with wet earth and the incongruously calm lapping of gentle waves on a shore. From the corner of his eye, he saw one of his fellow soldiers. He was positioned just like Cole, naked and spread-eagled to an upright, X-shaped timber frame. The blurry form shuddered violently, drenched in red wetness. There was something terribly wrong about the shape of the man's body.
"And now it's your turn,"
the Kaskan voice whispered in his ear from behind. Cole leapt with fright, his restraints biting into his flesh. A crow-faced man stepped into view, right by Cole's side. His bearded face was spattered with blood, and his teeth shone in an ill-fitting grin. He held a long and savagely toothed, two-handled copper saw. Cole tried not to look as the fellow mopped at the saw with a filthy rag, wiping the remnants of the last victim away. Crowface flexed his fingers and took hold of the handle at one end of the long saw, a second warrior stepping over to hold the other end. Like men pulling a piece of furniture into place, they passed the saw between Cole's spread legs and carefully lifted it, so the ragged teeth lightly touched his crotch and genitals. So delicate, so expert in their movements. Cole shivered violently. Crowface nodded once to his comrade, behind Cole, then yanked up and back hard. The copper saw rasped like a hoarse lion. Cole's blood and tatters of his skin showered Crowface. Pain, white, maddening agony. The noise that lurched from Cole's lungs was inhuman, like an animal mangled in a trap, his face agape and his neck cracking back to look skywards. There was a moment of quiet, just enough for the fire of the wound to flare in full, then rasp. The saw was pulled back by the fellow behind Cole. Cole closed his eyes tight, feeling the numb sensation of his tongue coming free in his mouth, chewed off in the blindness of agony. Rasp, 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 over and over. Blood, innards and organs splattered to the ground. Skin and cartilage groaned and stretched as his body was hewn apart from below.
"Be quick,"
another Kaskan hissed through the night.
"For someone approaches."
Crowface glanced over his shoulder into the mist, peering, uncertain, then turned back to the other sawman. The pair resumed their vicious work with great haste. Rasp, rasp, rasp. Lost in hideous torment, Cole's mind leapt in every direction that his bound limbs could not. Then, blessedly, the sound of the rasping saw faded away into insignificance, and his screams seemed to be coming from another, as gradually he returned to the vaults of the past. His sister was in his arms once more, hugging him, smiling, laughing at his tales.
"I've missed this,"
she said, looking up at him. He kissed her head.
"As have I."
A ragged cry rang out across the blackness, then faded away to nothing. The 61 wolves moving across the causeway halted.
"What was that?"
they whispered. Hattu looked along the front, eight abreast, Their eyes were wide, glinting in the starlight. Either side of them, the tranquil waters of the lake twinkling likewise, and up ahead, the small fog-shrouded islet churned and cast impossible shapes. He imagined in the mist swirling serpents, great birds, warrior wraiths.
"We have to be swift," he said softly to Tanku. "Order them onwards."
But Big Tanku seemed for once paralyzed with fear. Uncomprehending, Hattu followed his gaze, seeing something hanging from the branches of two skeletal trees up ahead. Webs, hanging across their path like delicate veils, dark, eight-legged shapes upon them.
I can't, Tanku said in a tremulous whisper.
Hattu looked down, seeing the big captain's feet anchored to the earth with fear. He lowered his voice so only Tanku could hear.
Walk behind me. I will see you safe, just as I did in the barracks, remember?
Then he turned to the rest of the wolves.
Together,
he whispered, taking the lead. The others clacked their shields together like a mini wall and edged along behind him. As they crept between the trees and into the roiling fog, Hattu flicked his spear tip up, silently cutting away the veil of webs. The way was clear. He shot a furtive glance at Tanku, whose tense features eased in relief.
Now be ready,
Hattu hissed over his shoulder to the 16 wolves at the rear, who went with their bows knocked and part drawn.
But be careful to identify your target before you shoot. We don't know what lies on this island. The priestesses may be here.
On they went in breathless silence, Hattu at their head. A toad croaked somewhere within the mist, and more than 60 yelps were stifled. Then they saw curtains of fog part to reveal shapes. The wolves halted, crouching, breaths stilled. Hattu peered through the drifting fog.
Men? He wondered.
Sentries, he was sure, seeing how they stood, feet wide apart, arms raised to their sides. But when a light wind parted the fog, he saw that they were not men, but creatures, for they glistened like halved pomegranates, dripping red from the grievous openings that stretched groin to chest. He now saw the frames upon which the pair were fastened, the nails that had been hammered through their shins and palms so they could stand. Underneath each lay heaps of steaming, purged, blue-veined innards. The leftmost wretch was dead. The rightmost one, however, was not. Hattu took a step forward cautiously, the whispered fears of his men sounding behind him. The rightmost wretch's head rose, shaking like that of a newborn fawn. His face, grey as a storm, gazed through Hattu.
Kol?
Hattu croaked, his heart plummeting. Kol's bloody lips moved silently, as if he was telling a tale to an absent other.
I'm sorry,
Hattu said, his throat closing up as he thought of the strong, handsome warrior of the Eagle Kin he had asked to escort the temple procession. Now, he was but a butcher's scrap. Without a further heartbeat passing, Hattu drew his sword and pressed the curved tip quickly into Kol's ribs, splitting his heart. In a trice and with a wet sigh, the life was gone from him. Hattu withdrew his blade, his shoulders slumping. But something deeper in the mist moved, and he realized it was not over. A figure moved in the grey ether. This time it was like a dream, for she was a priestess, a Hittite priestess. And it was...
Atiya,
he stammered. It was her. This was no dream. But when a muscled arm wrapped around her throat, holding a dagger there, it became a nightmare. The mist parted, and a lion's skull appeared just above Atiya's head, Pitaga's face snarling between the long fangs.
The cursed sun,
he hissed, his dagger arm tensing. Tears spilled down Atiya's cheeks as the Lord of the Mountains drew her back a step, then another. Hattu found himself unconsciously being drawn with them, pace by pace, towards the far shore of the islet.
Hattu, stop!
Tanku cried. Hattu swung round to see the mist either side of him swirl violently. An instant later, small knots of Kaskans shot into view, 10 coming from either side. Hattu swung up his shield in one direction and sword in the other, but knew at that moment he was dead or captured, certain the former was preferable. But with a thrum, the bowmen in the wolves loosed their arrows, and a clutch of Kaskans fell. Hattu struck his spear tip at the axe of one who kept coming, deflecting a blow, then rolled clear of another. An instant later, a clatter of bodies and bronze sounded as the wolves leapt into the fray. The fighting was swift and brutal. Tanku hacked clean through the shin of one Kaskan, then drove his sword down into the man's heart. When another mountain man sliced the top of a Hittite soldier's skull off with an axe, Hattu lunged forward to pierce the Kaskan's belly with his spear, forcing the foe to his knees, then kicking at the man's face to release the weapon. He swung round just as Dagon plunged his mace into another warrior's chest. The fellow went down, wheezing a mizzle of blood, and a moment later, it was over. Hattu looked this way and that for the next opponent, but the few left were melting into the mist towards the back of the islet.
Hattia!
He cried, throwing down his spear and shield and drawing his curved blade as he staggered down the shingle bank, reaching the water's edge, splashing in shin-deep, the wolves coming with him. Pitaga was already out on the waters aboard a raft, his surviving warriors clambering aboard with him. Atia knelt by the Kaskan lord, on a rope leash, weeping.
Hattu!
She wailed.
Hattu, don't come for me, do—
Pitaga's fist cracked across her cheek, ending her words. She slumped to her side on the raft deck.
You'll die for this, you cur!
Hattu roared. Pitaga laughed long and loud.
Will I, cursed son? It looks to me like it is you and your kith and kin who stumble further and further from home, ever in my wake. The earth you tread is mine, and every tree, hill, and river will conspire against you. Soon you will be joining your brother.
He smiled, gesturing to the top of the raft mast, where a spear was affixed. The sight of Sarpa's black, hairless, desiccated head atop it stuck like an invisible lance into his heart. Hattu fell to his knees in the water.
Go back to your ale in Labana and your cub of a Tukanti, weak prince. Tell them, and all your generals, how I mocked you tonight. How I mount a princely head on my raft. How I plan to melt the silver storm god into trinkets for my whores. How I will defile the last of your stolen priestesses.
The blood thundered in Hattu's ears as Pitaga faded into the blackness hanging over the lake. Chapter 18. The Bowman and the Bull, Summer 1300 BC. On returning to the camp, Hattu was intercepted by Muwa and a knot of advisers. Hattu gave his report as flatly and factually as he could, trying to ignore what had gone between them before, trying to stick to Nuanza's maxim of calm. But Muwa exploded with ire, tugging at his own hair, calling out to all nearby and highlighting Hattu's failure to apprehend Pitaga, rescue Atia, or recover the likeness of Tahunda. It was Nuanza and Coulter who led the chosen prince away, leaving Hattu standing alone, enraged. So Hattu returned to the wolves' camp area, mind aflame. Until he saw the lone bedroll that would go unused tonight and forevermore. The wolf, who had been struck in the head at the islet. Suddenly he felt a terrible sense of guilt at having volunteered the wolves for the sortie. He curled up and closed his eyes to escape his thoughts, to get what sleep he could. But when he collapsed in his bedroll and his blood finally cooled, he suffered a night of terrible dreams. In one, he was walking gaily with his comrades into a cave, whose mouth was rimmed with sharp stalactites and stalagmites, and from within which came a hot, fetid wind. On they went, none of them noticing how the ceiling of the cave became a series of ordered ridges, like ribs. Next they came to a boiling, dark red pit. He realized at last that they had wandered into the belly of a beast and swung back to the cave mouth, only to see the upper and lower fangs of stone gnash shut. The hot boiling pit rose to burn them all in the darkness, sucking the air from their lungs and melting the skin from their bones, all to the sound of Pitaga's laughter. The next day he rose at dawn, and the army set off at haste in the direction of the lake, picking up the Kaskan spoor once more. The far shores were pocked with the debris of a large enemy camp, and the tracks leading on from it took them in a wide northwesterly arc, through wooded tracks and wide grassy plains, the hot sun baking them as they went. By late afternoon, the country grew a little less green, a little drier and dustier, and they reached a forked valley with three tines. All three bore the markings of boots and hooves. Muwa drew up a hand, and the column came to a halt, then sent one scout down each route.
Three routes. Three chances to be ambushed,
Hattu mused to the wolves. His words were overheard by the nearby ranks, and he sensed many eyes upon him. Not like days past, when their glowers would be accompanied by mutterings about the cursed sun. Now their eyes were bright with esteem, but also shadowed with a new concern. What would happen next between Hattu and the Tukanti, their newfound talisman and their beloved chosen prince?
Fill the roots with rock and dust. Block the caskens beyond, Big Tanku mused with a mirthless laugh.
To what end? Pitaga would dig his way out like a worm. This isn't going to end until we confront him,
Dagon argued.
And to confront him, we must catch him.
You think he flees?
Hattu asked. Dagon and Tanku gave him a puzzled look.
That night on the islet, he was not afraid. Hattu's eyes darted in thought. Think of his ploys so far. Not the hasty ruses of a panicked mind. The Carrion Gorge was well prepared, wasn't it? Nuanza's archers found rich stocks of spears and rocks up there atop the gorge sides, gathered over a period of months, ready to hurl down had our army passed through there unawares. And the woods, the honey, that was deftly done.
Dagon, resting on his haunches, bit into an apple and looked down the three tines.
And then there is the bait that draws us on in his wake,
he said. He looked up, meeting Hattu's eye.
The last priestess, and the silver likeness of Tahunda. There is no more shameful loss he could have inflicted upon us.
She's not lost, Hattu said immediately.
Atea? By the gods, no, she isn't,
Dagon agreed, standing, clasping Hattu's shoulder. The dust of a rider rose from the northernmost tine. The scout returned to the generals and pointed down the path whence he had come.
The Caskan tracks continue on through that route,
he said, loud enough so many could hear.
More, there is a Hattanzuan village along the way. I saw her there. The hag who gave us the honey.
Volker bristled, as if he had heard his own name.
Then she and the rest of them shall be arrested,
he said immediately.
And let me take her force ahead at haste, and the rest of the column can follow.
Muwa gazed down the route, considering this.
Take a pair of companies and apprehend the hag.
He pointed to Slit Eyes and his hundred.
Take the Leopard Clan,
he said, then continued to look along the halted column, eventually meeting Hattu's eyes.
And the Mountain Wolves.
Tukanti, Kurunta interrupted. The wolves are depleted, from Bakka, and from their sortie to the islet last night.
The fiasco at the islet,
Muwa said.
I'd have thought the wolves would be eager to make up for that. Their second failure to apprehend Pitaga as soon as possible.
Hattu, eyes shaded by the brow band of his helm, was unblinking. Muwa's gaze and his clashing like spears.
But surely a veteran company would be better suited,
Kurunta persisted.
You trained the wolves, General,
Muwa barked. Kurunta's eyebrows shot up.
I took them to the edge, Tukanti. And none more so than Prince Hattu.
Then they are ready for this.
He twisted back to Volker.
Take them.
But Tukanti, Kurunta protested further.
Do the men not acclaim the wolves and this son of Ishtar?
Muwa snapped, throwing out a scathing hand towards Hattu.
Well?
Kurunta said nothing, though his stance suggested a few fierce thoughts swirled in his head.
Wolves!
Muwa cried like a drill master. Hattu and the wolves jogged forward, their boots crunching, shields jostling. As they moved along the column, many they passed gave them firm nods, and some dared to throw clenched-fisted salutes too. They reached the front, then waited as the Leopard Clan formed up alongside. Hattu avoided Muwa's gaze now, but his lips quivered with anger, on the cusp of shouting the darkest oath ever uttered. Kurunta strode over, grabbed Hattu's bicep and shook it.
Your brother's head is in disarray, he whispered, but due to the king's malaise, he is our leader. We cannot turn upon each other out here in this strange land, so put his anger from your mind. Think only of what lies ahead. If you run into Caskans along that route, get your shield up, get your head down, and fend off everything they throw at you. You hear me? The men of this army believe in you now. Live. Let them continue to believe.
Hattu looked across the wolves. Each of the young men he had trained with wore hard looks, their faces bearing cuts and scrapes, and their hair tousled and ragged. "We'll do as you trained us to, sir." Volker waved the group ahead.
"March!"
A small party trooped on ahead at speed, the rest of the column following on at normal pace in their wake. Soon the advance group lost visual contact with the rest, and they jogged alone along the dusty vale. After an hour they slowed at a low hummock. Volker climbed up, crouched and looked ahead like an eagle. Further west the vale widened. By a still brook-fed pond lay a small village, hemmed on three sides by a sea of yellow gorse bushes. Hattu spat the dust from his lips, eyeing the place. A simple collection of timber shacks and animal corrals. A well, a small row of market stalls heaped with bright fruits, and a few workshops where smiths worked copper and men milled wheat. And a small wooden handcart, resting by the gates.
"Hatton Zuans," he whispered.
Then saw the old hag shuffling over from the well outside the village with a bucket of water towards the handcart.
"Oh, the hag,"
Tanku said with a tremor of ire in his voice.
"She nearly killed us all,"
Kisner growled. "She gave us the poisonous honey," Hattu reasoned, "because someone forced her to."
"You don't know that,"
Sargis argued. "I saw it in her eyes. She knew what she was doing was wrong," Hattu countered.
Yet she still did it," Tanku said.
"Hattu's right,"
Dagon reasoned.
"Why would an old woman in an unwalled town want to make an enemy of an army like ours?"
"For the same reason as the Gallismans,"
Kisner conceded.
"Bataga has threatened them."
"Of course he has," Hattu agreed. "But unlike the Gallismans, these people have no army. No choice."
"Then what do we do?"
Tanku asked. "As we were ordered. We question them," Hattu explained. "If they see we mean them no harm, the Pitaga's threat is removed by our being here, then they will perhaps tell us what they know." Volker stood.
"The approach is clear. With me,"
he said. The tall Sherdan hoisted his trident and broke into a quick step. The leopard clan and the wolves fell into place behind him. Hattu saw the faces of the village folk turn to the approaching troops.
"Faster,"
Volker said as they drew closer. The party broke into a light run. Now the village folk froze. Some of the men snatched up poles and hoes, farming tools, none of them true weapons.
"Sir,"
Hattu said over the rumble of their boots,
"they're frightened. We should approach carefully so they know—"
"Get a run!"
Volker bawled over him, then sped forward. With a cry, the leopard clan went with him, hoisting their spears when Volker pumped his trident aloft.
"They think we're attacking them,"
Hattu yelled over the din, but none listened. On the wolves ran in the wake of the rest, glancing at one another, confused. Now the Hatton Zuans scrambled in fright, women and children running, men throwing down their crude implements. But there were a few who stood their ground. One fellow tossed a pole at them with a terrified scream. The pole thwacked against the shield of one of the leopard clan.
"And the treacherous Hatton Zuans attack us!"
Volker yelled.
"Slay them!"
Slit Eyes bawled. He wrapped his weapon against his small shield and waved his hundred into a charge. Swept along in the anger of what had happened in the clearing, they surged forward with a guttural roar.
"This isn't right, Tanku!"
Hattu bawled over the din of their charge, slowing. The other wolves slowed with him, and finally Tanku did too. The big captain's face was dark with frustration at first, shooting looks at the recalcitrant wolves, then the rest. But his annoyance quickly faded when he heard the first piercing screams of women and children. They watched as just ahead the old hag fell to her knees before Volker and the leopard clan, dropping her water, hands up in fright.
"Pitaga said they would spare our village only if we fed you the honey,"
she stammered, before Volker's trident lanced into her eye. With a spurt of white, milky matter and black blood, she crumpled onto her side like a dropped rag. Volker and the leopard clan spilled across the village grounds. The horn-helmed Sherdan was ferocious, leaping to and fro, his red cloak swishing like a counterweight to his trident. He struck down millers, smiths, weavers, herdsmen. The hundred men of the leopard clan went with him in a fervent spree, chopping out at everything that moved. Pigs and sheep squealed and bleated in terror as corral fences were booted over.
One young woman ran for the cover of a mud hut when the tip of a thrust Hittite spear punched through her breastbone and hauled her back. Arrows spat across the small space, shooting down dogs and elderly men who were clustered in one corner, quivering. "Not a soul raises their weapons to these people," Hattu demanded flatly, as the wolves jogged into the village in the wake of the slaughter. Not one did. Tanku did not challenge him.
"Enough! Enough!"
he screamed as they came to the well where Slit Eyes had cornered an unarmed man and run him through with his spear. Slit Eyes took heed, blinking and shaking his head as if breaking free from a spell. He saw nearby the tiny, swaddled, crying baby the fellow had been trying to protect.
"What have I done?"
he quailed, stepping back from the body of the man and the screaming babe. He had but a trice to consider his own question before a young boy ran into him, shouldering him in the stomach. Slit Eye's arms flailed as he toppled into the stony ring of the well. His cry was shrill and short, ending with a thick, bony crunch. The cry of the slain captain only spurred Volker and the Leopard Clan men on more. They slew with fervour, kicking over carts, wagons and stalls, and even butchering pets. When one Leopard Clan man came for the boy who had dispatched their captain into the well, Hattu stepped forward and thrust out his spear, blocking the soldier's sword strike. The veteran soldier swung to face Hattu with a snarl.
"What do you think you're doing?" he roared.
"Serving the Grey Throne with honour. Slaying farmers is not what we were trained to do." The soldier's face creased in anger.
"Wait till the two Canti hears.
Nor is it what the two Canti asked us to do," Hattu cut him off. The soldier took a step towards Hattu at first, but when Dagon, Tanku, and the rest of the wolves closed up around him, the man backed off.
"Run,"
Hattu hissed at the little boy they had saved. The lad scampered away, snatching up